Officially, college athletes are unpaid amateurs on campus to get an education, even if a sports scholarship brought them there. But Northwestern University football players say they're really university employees, and they've petitioned the National Labor Relations Board to form a union. Not for money, they say, but for better medical and health insurance coverage. Are college football players student athletes or student employees? I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we'll talk with Ramogi Huma of the College Athletes Players Association, which is working with the Northwestern players, and we'll review the legal issues involved with Northwestern labor law professor Zev Eichen. Focus continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Coming up later on the program, we'll be talking about the subject of college athletics and whether college athletes should be treated as employees of universities rather than simply students. The case we'll be talking about are the Northwestern Wildcats football team. Members of the team have petitioned the National Labor Relations Board to unionize. And a hearing before an NRLB hearing officer in Chicago is scheduled, I believe, for tomorrow. Some scheduling issues has delayed our first guest, Ramogi Huma of the National College Players Association. But in a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Zev Eichen, a professor of labor law at Northwestern, to get a closer look at this issue. And we hope to have Ramogi Huma later on the show as well. Right now, we turn to another event, maybe not as momentous as college football, but it depends on whether you were there. And I confess I am old enough to remember seeing it on television 50 years ago this Sunday when the music world changed. The Beatles made their first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964. And the two songs they played introduced many people to the Fab Four and inspired countless musicians. Illinois Public Radio's Brian O'Keefe has the story.
Kurt Muspratt was just a boy in Canada at the time of the British invasion. Today, he's the conductor of the new Philharmonic Orchestra at College of DuPage. While classical music is his forte, he doesn't deny the Beatles' impact on both music and culture.
I was writing a piece about Puccini, and I said, no matter how you feel about a composer, whether it's Puccini or Lennon, you know, and I was putting Lennon in the same category, or McCartney too, of course, as Puccini, because I think they are like unlike any other rock band ever. And I think we all feel that way, whether we're jazzers or we're classical people. When they started with She Loves You or Please Mr. Postman, yes, that was a whole new kind of music and a whole new sound with the invasion. But then they went on to Sgt. Pepper's or Rubber Soul. So I think they're enormous, mostly for me, because of the way they grew.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand.
The Stones are the Stones are the Stones. Yes, Ruby Tuesday is different than Satisfaction. Okay, but it's still the Stones. You cannot say that about the Beatles' music at all, because every single album is completely, for me, it's almost like you have Bach, and then you have Mozart, then you have Beethoven, then you have Tchaikovsky, then you have Verdi, then you have Debussy. Every album is completely different, and sometimes not so rock and roll-y. I remember the first time my older brother brought home the album, you know, Sgt. Pepper's. I went, what is this thing with these guys with these weird uniforms and this, like, these horns and this harmony and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds? What's that mean, you know? And I thought, wait a minute, I want to do some rock and roll, dude, you know? But they changed and they grew. And those two, especially Lennon and McCartney, astonishing.
Come together.
When I was in first grade already, my friends and I went down and we cut up our old hockey sticks and some cardboard boxes and stuff like that. And we made a band called the Miniature Beatles, and we painted the guitars with our airplane model paint, and I was John Lennon because I had glasses already, you know, and we just put a record player inside the drum set, and then we charged a dime, and we did concerts in our basement. Now, all we were doing is just faking it, obviously, but it was like, you know, my mother, you know, said, it's okay, it's the Beatles. Now, really, if I had been Jimi Hendrix or somebody like that, no. Plus, I think just their style of making music and their way of saying to all of us, you can be rock and rollers, but you could do a song like Michelle, My Belle.
Muspratt says John, Paul, George, and Ringo didn't just make music more accessible, they had a conscience. Today, it's common to see rock stars lend their name to a social movement, but the Beatles were among the first to mix politics and entertainment.
When you look at, you know, especially Lennon and what he believed in and his thoughts about peace, and then you look at, like, Harrison going to, you know, to India and exploring different cultures and different kinds of music. I think the Beatles were very important about that. And I think the way they spoke about, you know, equality of races and equality of human beings and those kinds of things and how important just each one of us is as a human being was part of a movement.
50 years after that performance on the Ed Sullivan Show, fans still embrace the Beatles, and new fans continue to discover their music. Muspratt says their timelessness isn't easy to pin down.
It's like any of those things of genius. Why does a movie like, Gone with the Wind, which is certainly dated, come on, or Dr. Zhivago, which is certainly dated, 1970s, not even 1940s, why does that grab people? Is it because the costumes are so fantastic, because the script was so well done, because the actors were so well chosen, because the site locations were excellent, because of the veracity of the story? You know, I mean, in our humanness, why do things of quality ring true to us, no matter whether we're looking at a Degas painting or a Beethoven symphony or a really good song from the Beatles? And I don't really have a good answer for you, Brian, but I would say it's one of those untouchable things. What do we find in beauty? What do we find in value? And why will we keep reading Shakespeare forever and ever and ever? I'm not smart enough to give you an answer for that, Brian.
He might not have that answer, but Muspratt knows this.
I think when we read an encyclopedia of music 100 years from now, 100 years from now, we'll be reading about the Beatles. We'll be reading about the Beatles.
Lead me to your love. But still they lead me back.
I'm Brian O'Keefe.
And this is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. A hearing officer for the National Labor Relations Board in Chicago is set to hear a case of a type it hasn't heard before. College football players are petitioning the agency to form a union. Members of the Northwestern Wildcats submitted the petition last month. They say they're not seeking pay, although NCAA rules now allow colleges to pay stipends to college athletes. Instead, they say they need a union to negotiate better treatment, especially when it comes to medical care and health insurance that continues after their playing days. The case is between the players and Northwestern, but the real target may be the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, and the rules it sets for its member colleges. We're going to talk now with Zev Eigen, and he is a law professor at Northwestern University, specializing in labor law. He's an associate professor at the School of Law, also associate professor of management and strategy at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, and a research fellow with the Center for Labor and Employment Law at New York University School of Law. Professor Eigen, welcome to Focus.
Hi, thanks for having me. Do I have enough titles, or do I need more?
Well, if you have some more to throw around, I'm sure we'll be ready to share.
Super. uber fancy person. Is that good?
Okay.
Awesome.
Well, I'm wondering, this is an issue which people are talking about all over the college football world.
Yeah.
But it's your school, and I'm just wondering what you hear on campus, you know, as this whole thing has unfolded from, you know, how are people talking about this at Northwestern?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't have any inside information. I'm not friends with any of the players, nor do I know Mr. Huma personally. So I don't have any, secret inside personal information. But my understanding is that, there's a lot of, as you may imagine, there's thoughts on both sides of this equation, right? So there's a lot of support for student athletes in general, and there's a lot of support specifically for these football players, for sure. And the interests that they're espousing, I think, are, universally heralded as good ones. So, you know, I think, as you mentioned in the intro, they do care about medical expenses. They care about loss of funding if they stop playing. There's a very low graduation rate among these athletes. I think it's approximately 50% across the board for student athletes. And, of course, there's the ongoing issue of traumatic head injury, particularly in sports like football and concussions, which, I think, as Mr. Huma said in another interview, they just want a seat at the table to be a part of those conversations. And I think that those issues are, I think, relatively lauded and supported.
Okay. And I'm wondering, when you say something like that, I just expect to hear the word but.
Yeah, I mean, the other side of the equation is, I'll just give you the other side of the equation. I'm not going to tell you which, we can talk about what my views are if you want, but the other side of the equation is that these are people who have self-selected into a path, right? And they're making a bet, if you will, right? They're betting that this road, this path of athleticism will lead them to something, and they're making a bet. Is it a good bet? Is it a bad bet? I don't know. But it's not like they're being coerced into investing this much time and energy into something while they're a student. That's their choice to do it. Are there risks associated with it? Yes. Is it a high payoff? Well, yeah, for the people who make it, it's a high payoff. But is it a low expectation that they will get the high payoff? Yeah. In our society, we let people make bets, and when people make bets and they don't pay off, they shouldn't also be allowed to cash in anyway. That's the kind of other side of the coin. Plus, there are other looming questions, right? So, if these people are employees, what are the tax implications? If they're paid and they're considered employees, does it mean that they're now in a professional league? Which has all sorts of implications for NCAA play and other things. So it's a question of having your cake and eating it too. They may not want all the things that come with the status of employee.
Well, we can continue this discussion now, and I want to note that you mentioned Mr. Huma. That's Ramoki Huma of the National College Players Association, and he is also with the new organization, I believe, which is hoping to be the union, if that's possible, for the Northwestern football players. And Mr. Huma, who is a former UCLA football player himself, is on the line with us as well. Mr. Huma, good morning and welcome to Focus.
Good morning. Thank you. And actually, I just caught the tail end of that. A couple of things I'd like to address. Number one is, and I heard it, I'm not sure who else is on here, but the idea that because college sports is voluntary, players shouldn't have basic protections. I mean, we're making the argument that players are employees, and every employee in the nation is volunteering for their job. There's nothing that mandates players, employees anywhere to have a job, but that doesn't mean they should give up their basic protections. So I just wanted to chime in on that, but I didn't catch the whole conversation, but I think that that's pretty important.
Okay, and I should say that Zev Eichen was essentially trying to lay down the two sides of the debate that he's been seeing. And Ramoki, before we go further, let's make sure that I'm clear on the organizations you're involved in. The National College Players Association is the older group?
Yes, that's a 501c3 advocacy group. It's a nonprofit group, and the new organization is a labor organization, the College Athletes Players Association.
And would that be the group that could become the union representing college football players at Northwestern? And you folks together, I understand you also have assistance from the Steelworkers Union have petitioned the National Labor Relations Board. And there's,
correct.
And there's a hearing before a hearing officer in Chicago. When is that exactly?
The hearing is going to start on February 18th.
February 18th. So it's been moved up a few days. We thought it was tomorrow, but it's actually another week or so.
Yeah, it was pushed back a bit.
Okay. And that really is going to start, I take a long process, unless you just shut down immediately, that any goals you're looking for are some way off.
Not even just the goals. I mean, even the decision. You know, the regional board will make a ruling. Whoever loses will appeal that to D.C., the National Labor Relations Board there. And likely whoever loses that will probably appeal into the federal court system. So this can definitely take a while. And, you know, the players at Northwestern understand that. They, you know, we told them, look, you might not be able to ever directly benefit from this, but this is for kind of the greater good, you know, the generations that come after you, and they rose to the challenge. You know, the other thing actually that I heard as I was coming on is the tax implications. And most people don't understand actually what they receive now is taxable. It's taxed as income. The room and board portion of their scholarship is taxed. The other part of the scholarship is not taxed. That would not change. If players are fortunate enough to negotiate something better, then, of course, they'll pay taxes on other types of compensation, but it would obviously be a net gain.
I wanted to go back to the Zev Eichen and ask you about what seems to be the big issue when we're talking about this, and that's the idea of the amateur, of the student athlete. Certainly, other college students work for pay. They work for universities. They work doing things in the field for which they're studying. There's not really much, as I understand, of a problem considered with that. What is the tradition and the thought concerning amateur status of athletics for students?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. In terms of their qualification as employees under Section 2-3 of the National Labor Relations Act, or just generally, what do you mean?
Well, I guess as the legal implications, how is it recognized in the law?
Yeah, so the board has flip-flopped on the issue of grad students, who are the quintessential hybrid of, if you think of it as employee and student, right? Because grad students get paid to teach classes, and if you're a university, the primary business model for university is teaching classes. Of course, athletics generates a lot of revenue as well, but that's allegedly a secondary endeavor. Now, you could argue about that. I think that's a pretty strong argument that it's not completely secondary given the amount of revenue generated. But universities are in the business of teaching people stuff, right? So grad students get paid directly to teach classes. They're directly involved in the work associated with the university, but they're also taking classes. They're also students, right? So they have this kind of hybrid status, the same way the student athletes do. And the board has flip-flopped on the issue of whether that category, grad students, are qualify as employees for purposes of gaining protection under the National Labor Relations Act. So, you know, you could argue about whether student athletes are like grad students or not, how much they are like them or not, and you can go back and forth in these arguments. I personally don't think it's the strongest argument in the world under the law, but I don't think that that's right. I agree with Mr. Huma that these guys need protection, but I view this whole process as a good step in the evolution of the protections needed for people in today's workplace. I don't think the current law, this is a 1935 act, right, that hasn't changed much, only been amended once since then, 1947, that is the protection offered to employees in this country exercising their collective voice. So under the law, I unfortunately don't think the athletes have the strongest argument, but I do think this is a great thing, and I do think it will hopefully bring more of an awareness to the issues of how fractured work is nowadays. And the people who do need protection, not just athletes, but other people.
Zev, I think you were mentioning the National Labor Relations Board, which is taking care of the Northwestern case, a private university. I'm understanding that for state universities, they would go through different channels?
Yeah, so that's a function of state law. So the main distinction point or dividing point for coverage, the National Labor Relations Act, the NLRA, is a federal law, and it covers private employment, right? So if you're an employee of the state, you would not be covered under the National Labor Relations Act. And so each state has its own individual laws that govern the relationship between the employer and employee and restrict the degree to which people can organize. And rights are often more restricted under state law than they are under federal law.
Now, I know in the case of the University of Illinois, when grad students organize to form a union, and they do have a union and a contract now, they work through the Illinois Educational Labor Relations Board. So
right.
That was a state agency specifically aimed at colleges and universities, I believe.
Yes.
Ramoki, what have you looked in this case and how your organization works with state schools compared to private schools and the athletes there?
Right. We're not going to comment on specific states. We want to make sure our organizing strategy stays confidential, but we do acknowledge the myriad of state laws and the fact that states govern each of the public schools in terms of labor law. But I would say I'd like to throw in, that's the big question, are players employees or not? And, of course, we're arguing that they are. But I think it was notable that the former chair of the National Labor Relations Board, William Gould, he predicts that we are going to win, that we do have the strongest argument. So it was very encouraging to hear him say that the other day, and we're confident we're going to prevail.
You were a football player at UCLA, and how many years ago was that?
I played 95 through 99.
And what were things like for you as a football player as far as being on campus and how your conditions were? What were the concerns you had then?
Well, as a player, it definitely feels like a full-time job. You're there, countless hours of mandatory and so-called voluntary time when they press you into doing things that they want you to do outside of the NCAA's work limit, which is supposed to be 20 hours a week. The NCAA itself did a study showing that the average football player spends almost 44 hours per week in their sport alone. And that's pretty much what it felt like. And it's not a complaint. Guys are willing to work hard, but they're not willing to give up their rights as an American citizen, and that's what this is about. What prompted me to start this organization was when I was a freshman, I watched my All-American teammate get suspended because someone left groceries on his doorstep and he ate the food when he didn't have any food in his refrigerator. Meanwhile, they're selling his jersey in the store, and that didn't sit right with us, but I immediately realized we didn't have a voice in the system. Going into summer workouts, they told us because these are so-called voluntary workouts that the NCAA actually prohibited schools from providing medical expenses during that period. And a lot of my teammates didn't have insurance, so that was another example. So, my issue as a football player, as I saw these things unfold, it wasn't that UCLA was treating us bad on its own. It was just that under NCAA rules, UCLA was prohibited from treating us better, from giving us basic protections. And that was the issue. That's the issue as Northwestern football players see it. They said explicitly that this is not an issue that that is a problem with Northwestern. It's how they're treated as Northwestern football players under NCAA rules, which they feel are unjust.
So it sounds like the NCAA is actually the ultimate target of your actions here.
Absolutely.
I want to just remind listeners that we're welcoming your feedback. The phone number here, 1-800-222-9455. And we welcome your emails. The address is will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And we do have one in from Dan in Urbana, who thanks us for having you on the show today, Mr. Huma. And his question is, have organizations of other kinds of campus workers, whether at Northwestern or elsewhere, supported the organizational campaign for the football players there?
We've received a couple emails from some supportive people, some on campus, some in the Chicago area. I don't want to name them at this point, but it was actually pretty encouraging. When these guys signed these cards, they were on an island, and they knew the steelworkers would be there to help support and that I would be there and Kane would fight for them. But it was a lonely place in that meeting. These were the guys by themselves making this decision. So to see the other organizations kind of begin to reach out even if it's just statements of support or offers of support, it means a lot to these guys. The NFL Players Association also strongly came out in support of this. They passed a resolution. So basically the NFL players are behind this. So it's been really encouraging.
Here at the University of Illinois, there is a campaign underway by a group, the Campus Faculty Association, to unionize the faculty. And our email writer, Dan, was wondering if you see any connection between the growing movement by college athletes and the growth in union organizing by college faculty.
I'm not sure if they're directly related, other than that, you know, work is work, and everybody in a workplace should have a voice, a collective voice, if they choose so. You know, and I think the problem is that in many instances, when they don't have a seat at the table and they can't collectively bargain, they're taken advantage of. And so I think that any worker that feels like they don't have adequate protections definitely should think about forming a union and grouping up with their peers, because that's the ultimate leverage that the workers have. So I think on a fundamental level, it's no different if you're a college football player or faculty at a university or a steel worker or an NFL player. It's all the same concept that, you know, too often when players or when workers are separated and they don't come together, they're taken advantage of.
We're going to continue this conversation about the proposed union for Northwestern college football players and then college athletes in general in a moment here on Focus. A reminder, especially because of the phone setup we have right now, we may not be able to take listener calls, but we certainly welcome your emails, and that email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. This is Focus on WYLL. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we are talking about college football athletes and college athletes in general, and whether they should be allowed to organize as a union for benefits and working conditions. My guests today are Ramoki Huma. He is with the National College Players Association and also with the New College Athletes Players Association, which is organizing with Northwestern University football players. They have a hearing scheduled later this month before a hearing officer with the National Labor Relations Board. Also with me today is Zev Eichen. He is an associate professor at Northwestern with specializing, among other things, in labor law. If you have questions for us, email is probably best today, the way with our current phone setup. Send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu with your questions and comments. Zev, I wanted to ask you, with this hearing coming up before the National Labor Relations Board, you've sounded supportive of the overall goals of the players, but you just wonder if this approach is going to work for them.
Yeah, let's be clear. If the question is should these guys get protection? Yes, I agree with just about everything Mr. Huma said. I fully agree. In fact, I'll even go a step further. I'm counsel to the Mixed Martial Artists Fighters Association. I'm a lot of the things Mr. Huma's talking about with feeling lonely and trying to get people to support a collective voice action for athletes. I've been trying to get mixed martial artists, along with the person who's founded the MMAFA, Rob Macy, to get protections for MMA fighters for several years now. It's a very, very hard thing to do. These are professional athletes who desperately need a voice, a seat at the table, and there's a lot of money being made. Talk about money being made off people's backs. A lot of money being made off of professional mixed martial artists, professional fighters. They desperately need a professional association. And so whether student athletes need protections and need collective voice, that, you know, whether they should have that is a very different question than you know, what the law is and how the law will treat them, right? So my personal view, and I could be wrong, of course. I would love to be wrong. Believe me, I'd be thrilled if I were wrong. I just think the current status of the law is that these guys they don't qualify as employees. Do I know all the facts? No. Could it possibly work? Yes. Am I hopeful that it would work? Sure. I'm thrilled to have more collective voice in the workplace. I think it's an important thing, particularly for people who need it, and especially athletes. So I'm very, very sympathetic and very, very hopeful that things will change over time. Like I said in a blog post I wrote, labor law is a very difficult area to get change because it's so highly polarized. you have people on both sides who are very either pro-management or dichotomously, oppositely, pro-labor, pro-employees.
Perhaps because of more than economic issues here. People really feel deeply about sports.
Yes. That's why I said this is a very highly polarized area, and you have strong views on either side, which is the perfect storm, the perfect recipe for inaction, right? For just stalemate. When you have both sides who argue the other side is partisan, very hard to get things changed. I'd be very, very happy to see the outcome of this be more acknowledgement and a greater sympathy for people who need collective voice, not only athletes but other people in our workforce. But I'm sure Mr. Huma will, I would be surprised if he didn't agree. There are also people who are deeply opposed to movements like this and deeply opposed to unionization generally, both in the private sector and the public sector. That's an argument that a lot of people can have in this country.
I have a question here via email from Mike, and I want to throw this over to Ramoki Huma first and then go to you, Zev, on this. And Mike is asking just for your opinions on what basis a college athlete is classified as an employee. And Mike is looking at different types of college athletes or different types of sports and noting that it's really football and men's basketball, which are the big revenue producers in college sports. Football is certainly a big revenue producer. Is that a basis that you're making as part of the argument for football players, college football players being employees? And if that's the case, what is the status for college athletes who are in sports that are not big revenue generators?
I think those are very good questions. We are obviously starting with FBS football and Division I men's basketball because we feel those are the strongest arguments, and we have to start somewhere. I think down the line it's possible that players of other sports on scholarship may also be classified as employees. And down the line, it's possible that they also choose to join a union and try to collectively bargain. In terms of, you know, what makes them employees, you know, that's a question for our lawyers. They're going to make the case. But in general, you know, some of the things the board will be looking at is, you know, what is their primary purpose on campus? Is it to be a student or an athlete? You know, obviously, most of these players, you know, across the nation are on campus specifically because they can play ball. They were recruited. They were offered scholarships well beyond, you know, back when they were 15, 16, 17 years old, you know, and had very little to do with being a student. It had everything to do with being an athlete. The, you know, are they paid to play is another thing they're going to be looking at. Well, they're compensated, absolutely, in the form of a scholarship. And that scholarship is actually conditional. You know, their continued receipt of that scholarship is conditional upon their continued service for athletics to the school.
It's a year-to-year case, I understand, at most schools.
Even if it's not, even if it's a four-year. You know, at this point, few schools offer four-year scholarships. But even on the four-year scholarships, you still have to go to practices and workouts and games. If you don't show up, your scholarship is gone, okay? It's conditional. You spend more hours in athletics than you do in academics, as the NCAA study has revealed very clearly. And the amount of control a university has over these athletes, you know, and actually, Zev, you're an employee of Northwestern, and I don't have to guess that you have more freedoms than these players do. You know, these players are told when and where they can eat, what they can eat, where they can live, how they can live, what they can even say in the media. There's all kinds of different things that really classify, in our belief, players as employees. Another thing is, you know, whether or not football is even related to academics. You know, it's one thing for the teacher's assistants, the graduate students, who the NLRB has flip-flopped on a bit. But arguably, you know, I think the last decision said that, well, what they're doing is actually helping their professional growth in academics. It's actually directly related to education. That argument cannot be made. And that was a deciding factor in the last decision to deny those students employee status. Well, football has nothing to do with academics. And obviously, you know, the more time you spend on football, the less time you have for academics. So it's actually counter to education. So I think these are the reasons why I would imagine why someone like William Gould, the former NLRB chair, believes that we're actually going to prevail. So it's I think it's a very strong case, and you know, it's going to take a while to unfold, but that's the general position.
Zev, what can you say about the difference between athletes in revenue producing sports in other sports at the college level.
Yeah, and first, like that, I like the arguments that Mr. Puma set forth. I agree with. I think those are the strongest arguments. The main issue here on whether these guys are employees or not is what is the primary relationship? I think as Mr. Puma pointed out, what is the primary relationship between the organization and the individuals? And as I noted in a blog post I wrote for Life of the Law, you know, if you had asked, I don't know, maybe this question would be answered differently. I'm curious to know what Mr. Humo says about this. If you ask Kane Coulter, he's the senior at Northwestern, the co-captain of the school's football team for 2 years now, plays quarterback. If you asked him to describe himself in relation to the school before Mr. Humo showed up, before the steelworkers showed up, before anyone showed up and talked about unions, he said, "What are you?" I would bet money, I'm not a betting man, but I would bet money he would describe himself as a student or an athlete, or a student-athlete, but I bet the word employee would not come out of his mouth. Now, again, it's about the fundamental relationship. Now, you could say, as I think Mr. Humo was pointing out, it's not really true that he's only an employee. It's not really true that he's only an athlete. And that's why it makes sense to me. This would be a much easier question, a much easier world, if the NCAA rules were different, right? Because you wouldn't have to put people in this situation where they're kind of students, but they're really working 40, 44 hours a week on the work of playing a sport. Why not let students and let schools track, right? The way it should be is, I think, my view, let schools track people. Either you're a student, track one, you're a student, and sure, if you want to try out for a sport, go for it. Or you are a paid athlete, track two. And, of course, if you want to take classes, go for it, right? But then the dividing line is much more clear, and it doesn't force both everyone, universities and students alike, to be forced to shoehorn themselves into relationships where you get this exact problem, just like Mr. Hoomer is describing, where you have people working and being directed to work for long periods of the week, but really they're not athletes, they're really students. Right, they're not really they're qualified as students because they're there ultimately to get an academic degree. But truthfully, they're there to play football. Which is it? Why not just track them, make life easier for everybody?
Well, isn't there the same gray area in even though they're working in their field for graduate students who work as teaching assistants or graduate assistants?
See, I think that's fundamentally different, which gets to this question of whether the issue is very interesting, right? Because with grad students, they are really hybrid. Right, because you have to teach. It's like learning by doing. They're going to go off, hopefully, a lot of them, and be professors. I was a grad student. I taught classes as part of, I received a stipend, and I taught classes, and I took classes at the same time, and I was writing and doing research.
But right? You were also doing work for the university, work that colleges and universities depend on,
right, so
more and more.
Exactly. This is what Mr. Huma said. I agree. So that's the point. Like, I'm getting paid to teach a class. And I'm also, and by teaching the class, I'm doing something that benefits the school, but it also benefits me because I need to learn how to teach classes because that's what I'm going to go off and do.
But I think this is actually less of a murky question, less of a gray area than the NCAA would have us believe. The NCAA would have us believe that it is impossible to be a student, an employee, and a college athlete at the same time. And that's false. These are not mutually exclusive. Zev, if you started taking classes at Northwestern and you continued teaching, you'd be no less of an employee and no less of a student. It's not mutually exclusive. So for us, it's very clear, and I think that's why we need to be at the NLRB in order to weigh in on that.
Let me set up a statement some of the organizations on the other side have made, and I'm quoting from a USA Today article from last month. This is a bit of the NCAA's statement from their chief legal officer, Donald Remy. Quote, "This union-backed attempt to turn student-athletes into employees undermines the purpose of college and education. Student-athletes are not employees, and their participation in college sports is voluntary. We stand for all student-athletes, not just those the unions want to professionalize. Student-athletes are not employees within any definition of the National Labor Relations Act or the Fair Labor Standards Act. We are confident the NLRB will find in our favor, as there is no right to organize student-athletes." And also in a statement from a Northwestern University, which is on a much kinder tone, but it does get down to saying that Northwestern believes that our student athletes are not employees, and collective bargaining is therefore not the appropriate method to address these concerns. However, we agree that the health and academic issues being raised by our student athletes and others are important ones that deserve further consideration. And that brings up another question. Ramogi, maybe, do you feel that the union is the only way to get what you want in terms of in terms of the questions about health benefits and just having enough to live on as while you're on campus?
Absolutely. I think, you know, and actually there's a lot of inaccuracies in the NCAA statement, especially one of which it says that it stands for all student athletes. That is a bold-faced lie, to be honest. They actually doesn't. The NCAA does not represent student athletes at all. They represent the schools. It does not represent players in one form of any form or fashion. And in fact, on concussions, their legal defense in their concussion lawsuit is, and I'm going to quote, "The NCAA has no legal duty to protect student athletes." That is not an organization that stands for any student athletes. So, you know, that's another issue. The other issue is, again, pointing out that, you know, they're saying this is voluntary. Every employee, every working American voluntarily goes to work. You know, that's not an excuse to suffer through mistreatments and deny them a seat at the table. And again, trying to turn players into employees, we don't have the power to turn players into employees, and neither does the NCAA. We're asking the NLRB to rule what this relationship is. Is it an employee-employee relationship? And if it is, it's the NCAA that turned these players into employees long ago when it started paying the players.
Zev, I was wondering, do you see other avenues in which some of the concerns of the players could be addressed?
I do. I do see other avenues, but just one quick point. Just, I'm curious to know, I can't resist. I'm just curious to know what Mr. Huma thinks about the response to the voluntary thing is that, and I'm very curious to hear your response, if you would like to make one, is that it's not about every job being a voluntary one, which is kind of true, not entirely true, but it's that people voluntarily went into the deal of being a student and spending, you know, getting scholarship money to attend a university where they get a degree at the end, hopefully. The goal is they get a degree, and while they're there as a student, they play the sport. So that's when the NCAA and others, I've heard make this argument that it's a voluntary endeavor. That's the deal. Like if I want to go into something where, you know, I'm going to make a bet. I'm going to bet you. I'm going to bet $1,000 on a very low probability event, and you take the bet. Right? You say, okay, that's cool. I'll take your $1,000. I don't think it's going to, you know, I don't think the event you're describing is going to happen. And then I lose, and then I say, whoa, I didn't mean to make the bet after the fact. That's the part that people don't like. You know,
you're talking about betting on the pro leagues? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, like if you're saying, okay, I'm going to try to do this thing where I'm going to get a degree from Northwestern or wherever, and I'm going to invest all my time there, and then, well, wait, I'm not going to spend a lot of time studying, so I'm not really going to, you know, whatever the bet is, or betting on pro league, whatever it is. That's the kind of voluntary part, which is different, very different than the voluntary nature of just employment generally.
I don't know that I would describe it as a bet at all. I think there's a lot of problems with that. But
I mean, like risk allocation. That's just another form for risk allocation.
Actually, going down that path with you, most people who set bets don't expect the game to be rigged. So that completely throws that whole model out because this game is rigged. It's not a fair bet. This game is controlled by an institution whose priorities is not to allow for a fair game. That's the problem.
Yeah,
the only way we get a fair game is for players to have a seat at the table.
I agree that they need a seat at the table. But anyway, I do think that there are other avenues besides the protections of the act. So even if this doesn't work out,
we've advocated for a long time. We've passed bills, yeah. Like I said, we passed bills on a state basis. We have a voice in Congress. There's a lot of different things we've tried. So through experience, lawsuits, everything, all the pressure points you have legislation you can have on the state or federal level, you have lawsuits, and you have public pressure. Okay. After having done this for over a decade, I can tell you unequivocally that these are not paths to comprehensive reform. And we don't have to guess. We don't have to guess how you get comprehensive reforms because we have models out there. We got the NFL and the NBA and Major League Baseball and hockey. they have a seat at the table, and they can negotiate for the protections. That's the only model that's going to bring forth comprehensive reform. Everything else is a losing prospect.
Well, what about the idea of an athlete association that is formed without the protections of the National Labor Relations Act?
Well, we've pretty much been operating that way. We have about 17,000 members, and we have a voice in various areas. We have a voice with the media. We have a voice with lawmakers. We can help launch lawsuits. But again, that's after having done all that. You look at a situation like concussions, where the NFL Players Association has negotiated a lot of protections for their players with the NFL. They've created a blueprint that really should be applied in NCAA football and even other sports. But instead of the NCAA embracing that, they're running away from it.
I just give you to
sit down at the table and discuss that. So that's case in point.
But here's the thing. So like there is an ability to leverage collective voice even without the protections of the X. For instance, in several states like Ohio, Illinois, there are public sector employees who have unionized and collectively bargained without the protection of any laws. But the fact that they've associated as a group and given and operated collectively, even without the protections of the National Labor Relations Act or any state law that would apply to them, they were able to have collective bargaining agreements put in place in other areas. And so my view is, I like the idea of trying to get protections under federal law, but failing that, you guys have a voice, and it makes sense to leverage it as strongly as possible. For the effect of the players to try. It sounds like even Northwestern is interested in trying to figure out the best way to ameliorate some of the health and welfare problems that are most pressing.
I would say, even if it
doesn't work, there are other avenues of collective voice independent of the National Labor Relations Act.
Well, we're not going to stop fighting, definitely, if we end up losing this argument. And I will point out, too, I agree that on campus, players have a lot of leverage. But I'll tell you this, Northwestern or Alabama or Miami, any other school in the nation, if it fell off the planet tomorrow, NCAA sports would not miss a beat. How do you get leverage with the NCAA itself?
Let me just jump in for just a moment here. This is Focus and WYLL. We're listening to Ramoki Huma. He is the president of the National College Players Association and the New College Athletes Players Association, which is working with football players at Northwestern in an effort to form a union. They have a hearing coming up with the National Labor Relations Board later this month. And Zev Eichen, who is a law professor at Northwestern University. I wanted to ask you, and again, I know there was a bill introduced in Congress last year called the National Collegiate Athletics and Accountability Act. It would try to reach some of the goals you're talking about, including a due process for players accused of wrongdoing by the NCAA and a required mandatory four-year scholarships instead of the year-to-year ones that we see now. If that had any traction, would it be helpful for you?
It would definitely be helpful. I mean, any ounce of leverage we can get, and that bill would also require four-year scholarships and allow a stipend for players. So those are some of the goals that we've been advocating for a long time. When we've been in Congress, I've done congressional briefings and hearings, and we have a bill in California that was approved, the Student Athletes Bill of Rights, that has actually been introduced in Congress by Tony Cardenas, who is also pushing. But getting a bill introduced is a whole lot different than actually seeing the bill even heard, much less passed in either House and signed by the president. So, we're going to keep pushing on that. We're not going to stop fighting on these various avenues. But the critical thing is this. Even Congress is, and I'm actually pretty hopeful about these issues, from the labor issue to Congress. We've seen it happen. Sports, I know that unionization can be polarizing, but sports is actually an area where people, they're sports fans from all political spectrums, and none of them want to see Kevin Ware carried off the basketball court, stuck with medical bills and losing a scholarship, period. And I think that people can come together. They have come together. We've had bipartisan support on some of the bills we passed. But as hopeful as we are for that, even Congress, by the time any kind of bill gets through Congress, it's not going to be able to address anything on a comprehensive level. That's very clear from our talks on the Hill. We might be able to pick out a few things, hope that those things stay intact through the entire process, in terms of amendments. Sometimes they get watered down. And again, it's not a lot of guesswork. You can contrast that with what the pros have done in their multi-billion-dollar industries, and those players have a seat at the table. That is the way that you can get comprehensive reform.
We're just about out of time. I want to just one last quick question for you, Ramogi, and that is, I know you don't like to be specific about this, but do you feel that you're close with any other groups of players who might be interested in organizing?
Right now, we're actually focused almost exclusively on making the case at Northwestern. You know, that's the most important thing right now. That hearing is coming up very quickly. That's where our focus is. You know, I have no doubt that, you know, fast forward a number of years, that we're going to have an association that spans across the nation because players want it. You know, players want it. And, you know, so I think I can tell you that eventually we'll get there, but I don't want to talk about the next steps.
Well, the Northwestern Players hearing before a National Labor Relations Board hearing officer is now set for, that's February 18th now?
Yes.
And that's in Chicago, starting off what could be a long struggle and process between college players seeking union representation and colleges and ultimately the NCAA opposing them. My thanks to you, Ramogi Huma, for being on the program today, and also to Professor Zev Eigen of the Northwestern University School of Law. Thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
And thanks to everyone who emailed your questions in today. Our apologies for those that didn't make it to the air. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Ryan Weber is our intern. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10. There's a replay at 8 p.m. Coming up on Tuesday, my guest will be Barbara Gerson, the author of Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. And on Wednesday, we'll be talking to some former Winter Olympians from Central Illinois as we go through the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. This is Focus on WILL.